You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is an evening lecture given by Brother Jonathan Wallace, titled, Finding God in the Emergency Department.
Good evening, fellow Manukanites. It's exciting to be here. This is the first opportunity I've had to speak for a Bible school in quite a long time. Not that I'm really speaking, but I was originally going to make this into an interactive lecture, and that kind of fell through. So I'm going to subject you to a few pictures. We better turn this thing on and hopefully keep you entertained. So relatively open format. If you have any questions, any protests that you want to make in the middle of this presentation, feel free to just stand up and let her rip. That's fine. While we're waiting for this to warm up, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Brother Jonathan Wallace, and by day, I am an emergency room physician. Usually people want to know where I practice, and it's a complicated answer. What I tend to do is work for smaller hospitals, not necessarily smaller, but underserviced centers throughout Canada. And so I've spent most of my 5 or 6 years now in practice, locuming at these various different centers. A lot of them in very, very remote places in Canada with unpronounceable names that you're probably glad you've never heard of. But so that's how I started out. And then somewhere into the middle of my practice, I realized that a lot of these places I was going to had surgical programs, but in order to run an operating room, you have to be able to put people asleep, and they have a shortage of anesthetists in Canada. So I actually went back to residency in a fit of foolishness and altruism, and retrained as an anesthetist. So I actually work as an emergency physician as well as an anesthesiologist. So I'm the guy who puts the epidural in and makes the laboring women smile and puts you to sleep before you go before you have your appendix out or whatever it is. So when I got the email asking what's the title of this program, what's the title of this presentation, I was actually in between doing an emergency C-section and something else that was a little bit gory that I'll spare you from. And I thought to myself, I'm looking at this email now and I should respond now, because if I don't, it's going to get lost in my inbox and Brother Randy's going to be getting an answer sometime in October. So I came up with this. I thought, you know, this sounds kind of interesting. I'm sure I can work with this, and I am going to work with this. But I'll give you the disclaimer right now that a lot of what I'm going to talk about tonight, while related, is not necessarily coming straight from the emergency department. I've got a few surprises in store for you, and hopefully enjoy it. So, what I'm really going to talk about tonight is a little bit of the human psyche. Specifically, the part of humans that allows us to look at a single object or a single circumstance, and depending on our background and our experiences and our the various other factors that influence us, we look at the same thing and come away with different views of it. And I'll get more into how that works and why that is. But really, what this presentation is on tonight is the human perspective, and how, for every one of us, it's a little bit different. It's not the same. So, let me just check my notes here, and let's move on. So, the way I wanted to introduce this was actually look at what humans are capable of. And it's quite apt that I've been given this fancy little ear microphone, because my first slide, turns out, is the Space Shuttle Discovery. Now, this thing, I'm a bit of a technical geek. I did my first degree in computer science, so you know I like to think I'm an engineer, but I'm just not smart enough for that. So, Space Shuttle Discovery, this is arguably one of the greatest accomplishments of humankind. This thing is huge. I don't know if anyone's actually seen these things now that they're decommissioned in the Smithsonian and whatnot. If you haven't and you get a chance, you should go check this out, especially if you have a little bit of a scientific nerd inside you. This thing stands vertically, right? We all know this. On the launch pad, you get these two controlled explosions that rocket it up into space, right? Okay, that's pretty impressive in itself. Then it gets into space, and it's cruising around at something like 76,000 miles an hour. Is that something? I think that's coming off the top of my head, but something like that. It's some ridiculous speed. And they can rotate this thing. You can see you're looking right down on, I don't know, something. And the Earth, thank you. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. That must have been an engineer. Yeah. You can rotate this thing around, you can open doors, you can launch satellites, you can retrieve satellites, you can dock it with the International Space Station, which is traveling 76,000 miles an hour. And then when you're done, you can take this thing from outer space and you can bring it back into the atmosphere, and it, because of the friction and the temperature differential, it reaches, you know, very, very high temperatures. In fact, I'll show you a picture, because I actually got to see this thing at the Smithsonian. And this thing was, you know, literally about 12 feet away, maybe even less. And so I got a nice picture of the panels there. As a science nerd, this really appeals to me. You can see the scorch marks on that. Maybe not on this projector, but you can see the scorch marks. It's amazing. So it comes back into the Earth's atmosphere, and then it glides without any engine power whatsoever from Honolulu to Cape Canaveral, or thereabouts, and it lands. Now that's pretty darn amazing, you know? I'll tell you what the greatest thing I've ever built is, and that's a deck. And I'm very proud of this deck because it's level and it hasn't fallen down. Okay? That's my greatest accomplishment as a human being. Maybe not quite, but it puts it in perspective. So, this is, you know, arguably one of humankind's greatest accomplishments. And as I mentioned, my first degree is in computer science, so I thought I would also talk a little bit about supercomputers as well. And here, I'll show you a picture of one. This is a little bit hard to read, so I'm going to read the caption. So this was made in 1954. Scientists from the RAND Corporation have created this model to illustrate how a home computer could look in the year 2004. However, the needed technology will not be economically feasible for the average home. Also, the scientists readily admit that the computer will require not yet invented technology to actually work. But 50 years from now, scientific progress is expected to solve these problems. With teletype interface and the Fortran language, the computer will be easy to use. I was showing someone else this earlier today, and we were joking about Fortran, and, you know, because Fortran is not an easy language to use. But that's because our home computers don't come with their own steering wheel. Wait, what's that?
Let alone two.
I know. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it when that comes out. This is what came out in 2004-ish, the iPhone. And if I ask for a show of hands, how many iPhones are owned by people in this room? I mean, it's probably, you know, not necessarily iPhones, smartphones. I mean, the computing power in this thing, I think I've got one in my pocket. I mean, it's incredible. This technology, if it existed, if it suddenly appeared in, you know, the 1942 on one side or the other, I think would have probably ended the war very, very quickly with the amount of advanced technology that we carry around in our pocket, you know? It's incredible. The smartest supercomputer in the world right now, I looked it up today, and it has, I better quote this correctly, it's capable of 34 petaflops per second. How many petaflops are you capable of? I'll tell you, because I did the math. That's how nerdy I am. So, do you guys remember Mad Minutes from elementary school? You get a sheet of paper and it has all these different math problems on them. I'm getting ahead of myself. 2004 technology, right? And this is obsolete now, right? This is an iPhone 1. So I thought I'd just give you a look at the lineup of iPhones to come. Anyway, back to the Mad Minute. You have a piece of paper with 30 of those calculations, and you go through it, and you're timed a minute, and you have to fill it. Did anyone else get subject to this horror? Yeah, okay. So if all of us did a Mad Minute, and let's say all of us are capable of answering questions like this 30 times a minute, which, you know, is not bad, and so, you know, based on 100 people in the room, we continuously do that without sleep, without a break, somewhere around the 1,000-year mark, we would be able to do what this supercomputer is able to do in 1 second. That's a lot of math. You guys are engineers, aren't you? Hate engineers. So the answer to this is 12, by the way. So I hope so. I can check it on my iPhone. So you've got the space shuttle, arguably one of man's greatest creations. Now you've got arguably one of God's greatest creations. This is the human brain. And there are about 100 of those in the room as well. More or less. Some of them are sleeping right now. This weighs 1,500 grams, which means a lot to about 20 of us in the room, and to the other 100 and whatever Americans, it doesn't mean anything. It weighs about 3 pounds. All right? We use 4% of this. And this is by far more powerful than the greatest supercomputer. Maybe not at mad minutes, but in some of the things we're about to talk about, I will show you how much more powerful this thing is. Interestingly, size does not matter. Women have known this for a long, long time, but size does not matter. And interestingly, the male brain on average is 1,800 grams, which is 3.5-ish pounds, and the female brain is 1,500 grams. So that's further proof that size does not matter. An elephant's brain apparently weighs somewhere around 6 pounds. Am I doing my math right? No, it was 6 kilos, 12 pounds. So it's about 4 times heavier. And elephants, you know, are... I've never really met an elephant, but they seem like intelligent creatures. But you can't really have a conversation with them. And I don't see elephants flying around in space in a space shuttle, right? So it goes to show that, surprisingly, there's something going on here that makes it different. And if you look at the anatomy here, every creature, every vertebrate creature has this similar brain stem, which controls your heart rate and your breathing and your cerebellum, which is responsible for coordinated muscle activity. So your dog has a very similar brain stem and lower brain. It's all the upper brain, the cerebellum, or pardon me, the cerebrum that gives humans their special abilities. And, you know, thousands of people have spent many, many years studying this, many PhDs, and we understand very little of how this works. We actually understand a lot of it, but we understand a very small percentage of the picture. So, what does the brain do? If you think about it right now, we are sitting in this room, and you're listening, you might be listening to me, and your brain is actually soaking in an almost infinite amount of information right now. You're looking at me, you're looking at the screen, but if you think about it, you're also aware of what's going on around you. You're aware that there's a bookshelf behind you, you're aware there's a piano, you're aware we're using a projector, you're aware of the people sitting around you, and that's just sight. You think about hearing, and you know, you've been listening to my voice, but when you think about it and you listen, in the background, over my voice, you can hear the fan running, and you might be able to hear the trees rustling outside if there's a bit of a wind. You might hear a toilet flush, and your brain just filters that out because that's irrelevant information. Same with, as John pointed out earlier, there's smells and tastes and sensation of touch. Right now, if you think about it, you can become aware that your clothing is actually placing pressure on you, right? But you don't think about these things while you're, well, you hopefully are not thinking about these things while you're listening to me talk. And that's one of the things that makes the brain so powerful. Yes, you can train a computer to go through this algorithm and sort out a whole bunch of mathematical yes and no answers that are quite elaborate, but what our brain does is it allows us to think about several things while we're whistling a tune and be aware of everything that's going around. And if our brain couldn't focus down and filter out some of that information, we'd be in real trouble. Because you could have a bear walk into here who's very hungry, and you'd be sort of sitting there paralyzed because you're looking at the pattern on the drapes, and you're counting the number of lights. And, you know, by the time you kind of get around to, oh, there's a bear there, and then that goes into the filing system, and then you kind of process it for a while, and in about 3 years you realize, oh, there's a bear there, and by then it's all over, right? And that's what the supercomputer would do. It would be able to analyze everything that's it can see much quicker, but not in time. It's going to get eaten by the bear. Maybe if it has a stake around its neck or something, anyway. So, how does this work? I want to just teach you a little bit of neuroanatomy, because I'm a nerd, and it's kind of interesting. So let's talk about vision. So in this room, we have several sources of light. We have the projector, we have chandeliers, we have a light behind me. Light bounces down on here onto this very well-made blanket that is of very high value. And the light hits this and it scatters off in a whole bunch of directions. And if you happen to be sitting, it doesn't really matter where you're sitting because I think just about everyone in this room can see it, but wherever you're sitting, you're getting a particular angle of light coming off of this. And those rays of light enter your eye, as in the diagram there. Imagine that tree is a very expensive, well-made blanket. And it enters the eye and it hits the retina, which is the back layer here, And it's broken down into impulses of color and of contrast, darkness and lightness. And it's encoded into these electronic signals. And from there it travels back through the optic nerve. It crosses and it goes back here into the visual cortex and the occipital lobe at the back of your head. And there all those signals are translated back into an actual meaningful image. But it doesn't stop there. So now we have an image of a blanket or a chair or whatever it is. And the association area, which is immediately adjacent to it, then looks at it and says, oh, that is a blanket. That is a chair. That is John Lonberry. Right? Lonchberry, sorry. And we immediately recognize it. And then we associate it with a feeling, an emotion, and past memories. So I sat on a chair once and I fell out of it. So I'm careful now whenever I sit down in a chair to, you know, not tip over backwards, right? And that all happens in a fraction of a second. I can flash up an image on here and immediately you will recognize it within, a tenth of a second. And you will have opinions on this. And that's what our brain does. It captures all this information, it sorts it, and it allows us to process this. So if I put up a picture, I was going to try and get one and just wasn't organized enough. If I put up a picture of Manuka here from last year, those of us who were here last year could look at that, and we would see the picture, we'd recognize it, and we'd say, oh yeah, I remember that. Simeon was up on the roof and he almost fell off, and I was standing next to so-and-so, and we were talking about this, and all these memories come back. The supercomputer comes back and it says, well, 89% of the pixels are, of this shade, and, 23% are, lighting in this area, and it really doesn't know what it's looking at. And that's the difference between human technology, the pinnacle of what we've achieved so far with computers, and what the human brain is capable of. All right. So we need to be able to do this. We are processing so much information at any given time. We have to be able to focus, just like that bear example. You have to be able to put your attention on what needs it most. The problem with that is that sometimes you get fooled. And I'm going to show you some optical illusions. They're not anything particularly impressive here. You've probably seen them before. This is the famous two faces or a vase picture. We've all seen this. Everyone can see both. Yeah. So this is a poor example of how you can quickly assess a situation and get it wrong. Right? You can look at that vase, never seen it before, right? And miss what's actually going on. Similarly, you get a picture like this, which I think we're all familiar with as well. And depending on where you're standing in that room, what angle you're looking at, it's a very different room. And it's very confusing, right? So similarly, when we look at a situation quickly, we can misjudge things. And that's how errors happen. That's a large reason, large part of why errors happen. So, this brings me to my first verse of the evening, Matthew 13:13. This is something we all know about, and we don't often think about it in this context because we're usually thinking about people who are, evolutionists who deny God and, though seeing they do not see, though hearing they do not hear or understand. But in reality, this is happening in each of us all the time. We are so busily going about our day, just as we have to, that we are missing little things here and there. And most of the time we get away with it, but sometimes we mess up a little bit. So I bring this to our attention because if we're aware of this, we can sometimes slow down, especially when you get into more high-stakes situations, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on, and hopefully prevent some of these misunderstandings and whatnot. So with that, I wanted to give you another example of misperception, and that's when you have a group of witnesses who see a crime. And so these are objective people who are standing by who have no interest in the crime itself. And if you take those three witnesses and you separate them and you ask them what happened and ask them about details, everyone's a little bit different, right? Because we all put our own little spins and biases on things and we fill in gaps that we don't have a clear recollection of. It's very confusing, but it shows you how that perspective can change so dramatically when you're witnessing the same event. So the interesting thing is, because we're so quick to judge at times, we often are, we have the potential to be missing the forest for the trees. And whenever you have a circumstance like that where you are too focused on one part and not seeing the rest, and the rest is relevant, that gives you an opportunity for epiphanies. And we've actually heard a bunch of epiphanies already this weekend. I've been thinking about this, and so when they come up in the various talks, I've been paying attention to them. One perfect example is from last night's exhortation, and that was, of course, the example of Hello, David. Right? Is David here? Good man. You should be sitting next to the exit. That way you can sneak out a little bit easier, you know? Hello, David. How many times have you heard that in your life? Thousands, right? I mean, but for whatever reason, that one particular instance you were telling us about last night was a special one. And you had a different perception of that event, that Hello, David event, than perhaps ever before, right? And that's one example. The next example I want to give you actually comes from one of our brothers who's here. So I'm going to ask Adam to come up and talk to us for a moment.
All right. So I'm Adam. Hi, everybody. All right. I'm the one from Honolulu. So that's my, in fact, my cousin John. You can see the family resemblance, right? He does a good job of putting people to sleep at work and here at Bible school. Yeah, I was sorry about that. So. All right. So I have, I guess, my job. I'm a helicopter pilot, and so I have some unique perspectives over things, maybe a unique point of view on things. So here's me at work in Alaska a couple summers ago, and the first thing you learn in pilot school is how to pose next to your aircraft. Right? It's part of the curriculum. So, my job right now, I live in Hawaii, I fly people around, right, doing that kind of stuff. You see the island from above, there's lots of rainforests and coral reef. We have mountains, waterfalls, volcanoes. It's really awesome. Get to see all that stuff. But you do it 7 or 8 times a day, and it kind of becomes routine, right? Like most work, it gets, it's routine. So despite the beauty of God's creation, you kind of start taking it for granted, and that's human nature. But it's one of the central themes of the Bible, right? You get comfortable, things are routine, you get in a rut, and you're taking things for granted, and then you end up spending another 40 years wandering in the wilderness, children of Israel. So something kind of similar to that happened to me. So the volcano that's active in Hawaii is called Kilauea, and this winter it got really active, and we started having lava flows going down into the ocean. So of course we're booked solid then, people dying to see this. So where I'm out flying 6, 7, 8 times a day, taking people over. The passengers are loving it. One particular afternoon, it's hot, AC is not working all that well in the helicopter. I'm tired and thirsty, and it's got boring. It's one of the most amazing sights in the world, lava flowing into the ocean out of this volcano, but I'm bored, right? It's kind of hard to breathe, but I think we can all relate to that. But all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, what do I see? Right? Boom, dolphins everywhere. A pod of dolphins just splashing around, swimming around. So at this point in time now, I've gone from being bored to now being the most excited person in the helicopter. So I'm just cranking the aircraft around, flying circles over these dolphins, loving life, to the point where my passengers are getting a little nauseated. And, time to take them back. Not a big deal. There's no shortage of passengers. So get more fuel in the helicopter. Get it loaded up. And out we go again to see it again. I'm out chasing dolphins. People are kind of wondering what's going on because they want to see the lava. Right? But my epiphany is to always remember to open your eyes, see the majesty around you. Don't get bogged down in the day-to-day monotony of things, which is so easy to do. So I thought of this verse, right? We've read it already. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. Matthew 13:13. Okay. Now, here we got a picture of lava. So what do we think of when we think of lava? What do we associate that with? Don't go near it, right? It's hot.
The Hobbit.
Yeah, the hobbits throwing rings into it. Waste of a valuable commodity. Right? So fire, death, danger, destruction, that kind of thing. Now, I was at one point in time a boy, so I have a different opinion of lava than maybe some people. So, I mean, we can get a show of hands. How many of us have been boys at one point in our lives? Right? They're still working on the cure. My cousin's, you know, leading the charge on that one. Fire is, in fact, awesome. Most of you are mistaken. But it hurts when you get too close to it. It's an agent of change and transformation. So you can think of turning all those ants to crispy critters with your magnifying glasses for science. Right? That's the most important thing. So, back on with the lava. So, lava, what I'm thinking of here, creation and the renewal of life. This is showing us God's power. How so? So it's easy to think that creation stopped after the after day six in Genesis, right? After Adam and Eve in the garden. And maybe you go, okay, we got Noah with a flood and everything. But God's creation is an ongoing process. So what we see happening in Hawaii, we have lava coming off the bottom of the ocean, and it literally piles up and makes an island out of scratch, out of nothing, right? Just pile of lava that people then kind of live on, and it's, you know, really awesome, beautiful place, ecosystems and so on. At a certain point in time, a volcano will stop erupting, and over time, the islands will actually kind of erode down away, the weather away, much like people, and kind of just get scattered away, and they're gone. So these islands have life cycles just like us. So you can forget that real estate saying they aren't making any new land. They are right now in Hawaii. So tell that to your real estate agent. Okay. So the islands are like us. God has laid that out for us to see. They're covered with life both above and below the water. Amazing creation, lots of beauty. And I have another verse here from Job. It's Job 12:7-10. So ask the animals, and they will teach you, or the birds in the sky, and they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and it will teach you, or let the fish in the sea inform you. Which of all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? It's in his hands that the is the life of every creature and the breath of all of mankind. After living in Hawaii for a few years and seeing the diversity and the changes as you go between the islands, they literally get older. The farther northwest you go on the chain, the older and older they get as you go up towards Japan. They range from about 500,000 years to 850 million years, you know, as best as we can age them with our ability. As scientists and whatnot. After Hawaii, or before Hawaii, I worked in Alaska for a summer. So let's think again, what do we associate with Alaska? Right? I'm hearing snow, mountains, cold, glaciers, right? So bears, can't forget the wolves either. Snow. All right, so it's cold in Alaska. It's a really beautiful place. It's one of my favorite places to live, even though I was only there for the summer. And what always got me from Alaska, so most of our work was taking people out to glaciers, letting them walk around, or dropping them off at dog sledding camps. And we would get the people, and we'd get out on the glacier, and they'd be like, no one told us it was going to be cold. Or we would have brought our coats. Yeah, no, seriously. So down at the cruise ship, they got off if it could have been 70 degrees or 60 degrees. Get up on the glacier, and it's snowy and cold. Who would have thought? Yeah. So glaciers are, pretty interesting. They might throw you a curveball like that. If you don't know, they form. You take hundreds of feet of ice or snow, and you compress it down because of the weight of all the snow that fell on top of it the next year and so on. And the hundreds of feet of snow get squeezed down in just a few little inches. Right? So you have all this water, all that same force of water, and it does some pretty awesome things, but slowly for us as people to think about. So it'll dig giant holes in the ground. It'll grind rocks down in a powder. You could take, leave piles of gravel the size of this building, but like miles long. And on top of this glacier, you can have, those bears running around, little marmots, like little weasels, the snow. You'll have rivers of water on top of the glacier, which if you stop and think for a minute, so we have water flowing on top of other water flowing, but the water's kind of got different timelines. Like one's like in slow motion and one's regular motion or normal time frame for us. But my favorite part of the glaciers were these ice caves, which is like being in some kind of dream world or a movie or something. You got water dripping around on you. Just this constant trickle of water in the background. You can kind of hear the glacier groaning as it's shifting and the wind blowing through there. It could still dangerous. The glacier can shift and trap you. It could fall on you. I mean, there's big rocks getting carried around by the glacier, so those could kind of fall on you. Don't tell my mom I was doing all this kind of stuff. This is indicative of Alaska for the most part. It's like the last frontier. There's bears, there's wolves around every corner. You got blizzards, sudden weather changes. You could get lost in the middle of nowhere, hundreds of miles away from nobody. Not to mention Bigfoot. Hopefully you would have this wonderful quilt to keep you warm. And it's also Bigfoot repellent. It's got that going for it. So, but all jokes aside, you feel kind of fragile. I guess in modern society we feel pretty safe. Hopefully most of us do at night. We don't worry about, bears eating us. But in Alaska you kind of get that sense that there's danger around every corner despite all this beauty. But we don't have to really have fear because we have faith in God. God is always with us. So you can think of, the children of Israel, going back to that, they're approaching the sea and God parts it. They have Egypt and Pharaoh and all those guys chasing behind them. You have fish flopping around. Again, this giant wall of massive water, everyone, everywhere around them. God has protected them and they make it out of that situation just fine. So the verse that really comes to mind for me with that one is Psalms 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they shall comfort me. So, it's easy in that moment when you're face to face with a grizzly bear or underneath a shifting glacier to be afraid. If you pause for just a moment, not too long, so the bear gets you, you can realize God is always with us. He's always there. We shouldn't be reckless, but God will protect us and watch over us. And that was the epiphany that I've gotten over these last couple years working as a pilot. So on that note of not being reckless, here's a picture of me jumping over lava.
Hey, thanks very much, Adam. Right, is this still on? Come here a second. Can you guys hear me? Okay, good. Hey, I've got something for you. Your mom wanted me to give you this. You left this down the back of the couch a couple years ago.
It's my jump seating tie from flying.
And some bank stuff. Hey, thanks. So, I figured that was more interesting than the stuff I talk about, so thanks for humoring us there. So, stuff like this is a perfect segue to what I do for a living. Perception. I don't know if you guys have noticed this before, as a keen observer of humankind. you ever noticed that people sometimes present themselves a little bit differently than everyone else? They kind of have this persona or this mask, and you see, you know, the staunch businessman who feels like he's in control of everything and micromanages, and you have panicky, I don't want to link this to any ethnicities or genders at all, but you have, you know, the panicky personality who just doesn't really cope that well with stress. And then you have the obsessive compulsive, very organized, not like me at all, detail-oriented approach, right? The interesting thing is that when people come to emergency, that often disappears. Because if someone truly believes that they're having an emergency, which is, you know, a reasonable amount of the time, they're too busy contemplating their inevitable fate due to the splinter in their toe or whatever it is. And you really get to see the human being who's underlying. And it's interesting. I'm going to tell you about one day that I had, I don't know, a while ago. And I had two patients on this day. And the first one was a 22-year-old woman who had a toothache. And she'd had a toothache for, well, it was about 10 in the morning. So she'd had a toothache since she woke up, probably about 7. And she was crying and sobbing, and one of the nurses asked her, you know, have you taken any medication for this? And she got this very angry, no, are you crazy? I'm in so much pain, just help me. And, you know, just kind of shaking and very, very upset. And then you have next to her in the next bed over this little old lady who's, you know, late 80s, who fell 3 days ago, broke her hip, lying on the ground, unable to move, and just laid there. Didn't want to call for help, didn't want to bother anyone. And eventually her neighbor comes to check on her and finds her and calls an ambulance. So you have these two patients laying next to each other, and I'm looking at the two charts thinking, okay, toothache for 2 hours, broken hip for three days, broken hip. And so I go and I talk to this lady, and she says to me, dear, you know, I'm okay. I really think you should go talk to this person next door because they sound like they're in so much pain. Can you believe that? I like it. Jaw open. That was kind of my reaction too. But I've part of the training in medical school is to try and keep your jaw closed when these sorts of things happen. It's unbelievable. And you see this. You see these people who are very high functioning in society, you know, judges or whoever, who are used to being in control and never questioned. And now they're in with chest pain and they think they're having a heart attack, and maybe they are having a heart attack, and they are not in control. And it's very interesting to see what the personality is underneath, because it's kind of like lifting up the mask and getting a peek at what's underneath. So, this brings me to a couple of interesting verses, because what I'm really talking about is the way people go through life perceiving things. They wear their rose-colored glasses. They wear the poor me, I'm in so much pain, I stub my toe glasses. Or they wear the I have to be in control glasses. Or whatever it is. We all have our rose-colored spectacles, whatever that rose color is. A couple of interesting verses. I think this is very true of the 22-year-old with dental pain. By the way, I gave her some Tylenol. She felt better, and we sent her to the dentist. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. So the first part of that, every way of a man or a woman is right in his or her own eyes, you see that a lot in emergency. People come in with very interesting expectations of what needs to be done because of their emergency right now, and often it's not compatible with reality. So part of my job is to try and diplomatically explain that. Another interesting verse. And this pertains more to my 88-year-old patient with a broken hip. A joyful heart is good medicine, which was clearly her, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. I come from the Butler legacy in Ontario. That's Ray and Beryl. Everywhere I go, people seem to know them. And I think we have at least 5 members of that family tree here. So my grandmother, Beryl, in the 80s, before I was really aware of what was going on, was in a bad car accident, and you can give me the nod or the shake if I get this wrong, but she had a very bad car accident and bad damage to her leg, and she was told by the doctors that she would never walk again. And within a matter of 6 months, a year, she was walking again. Does everyone see a show of hands? How many people knew my grandmother? Yeah. She was an amazing lady. A joyful heart is good medicine. But similarly, a crushed spirit dries up the bones. And you see people, I see people, hopefully you don't see these people, who are fading away because they don't have, they've lost the drive, they've lost that spirit to live or to try and help themselves. They become helpless. And that becomes a terrible spiral that's very difficult to rescue people from sometimes. Sometimes people come to an emergency only to find out that the problem isn't fixable the way they want. In Canada, we have this socialized healthcare system, and I know in the U.S. you hear that it's bad, but most of us are still alive, so we've survived it. People come in demanding an MRI, you know, which in Canada we don't sort of hand out like candy. We kind of only use it when it's really indicated. And there's a bit of a wait depending on how urgent the MRI is. If you need it today, you'll get it today. But if it's, you know, your hip and it really isn't that urgent, probably this is going to heal on itself, you're probably going to wait a few months to get your MRI. So people often come in because they are under the impression that they need an MRI and they think if they come to emergency, all of a sudden it'll get done. And of course, my job is to bring them back to reality. You get people coming in wanting to see specialists. You know, well, you know, I'm waiting to see the urologist, and I missed the appointment because, you know, my laundry was, you know, down at the laundromat, and I wanted to change it, and, you know, now they're telling me I'm going to have to wait 3 weeks, so I came here so you can get me to see the urologist. And again, there's a little bit of a re-education process there. Some of these people often leave complaining about, you know, not getting their wish. Interestingly, I'm not a genie. I had a guy who, I forget, I think he was a tree pruner, arborist, is that the right word, arborist? And he fell out of the tree and he banged his knee, and for worker compensation purposes, he was sent to the emergency department and he got an x-ray, and it was a busy day. You know, we were dealing with people who had actual true emergencies by the medical definition, not by the individual's definition, and he had to wait about 3 or 4 hours for the results. And this was right at shift change, and I came in early because I knew the department was busy, and I started seeing patients about half an hour early, and he was the first person I saw. And I went in, and he was very angry and had been yelling at the staff all day long, and I went in to see him with the results, and he's talking on his cell phone. And I kind of stand there, you know, I'm obviously the doctor, I happen to be wearing a white coat, and I sort of stand there for a minute, and he's just talking on the phone, and I'm like, okay, I'll come back. So I went, and I grabbed the next chart, went and saw a person, probably was only about 15 minutes, went back to see him, and he was just completely livid, and he had his cell phone out, and he was videotaping me. And I don't know if you've ever been videotaped like this before, but it's very, very uncomfortable. And so I kind of, a bit flustered now, I'm trying to explain to him, you know, not really comfortable with you videotaping me. Can you turn that off so we can, you know, finish this appointment? No, I'm going to videotape this and I'm going to send it to my lawyer. And lawyers in medicine, fortunately in Canada, are nothing like lawyers in medicine in the U.S. So I'm personally not at all worried about this. But it's still very uncomfortable because of the confrontation. So I said to him again, you know, I'm sorry, I can't continue if you're going to videotape me. I need you to turn that off or I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And he says to me, fine, ask me to leave. And I say, well, please leave or I'm going to have to call security. And he says, come on, call security. So that's what I did. And he was not very happy. He was spitting and cussing and yelling through the department, and all for a knee that was completely fine. You know, I could have told him in about 2 seconds that the x-ray is fine, but without that doctor-patient relationship, you can't really proceed anywhere in the therapeutic treatment. You know, I can't really say it's okay, what you need to do is, because as soon as he hears it's okay, he's going to throw his stuff away and leave and not really hear the follow-up instructions, right? So he actually had to go to another doctor to get the results so that he could actually get the advice and the follow-up that he needed, which is kind of odd. And that's one of the more stressful events I've ever had as a physician, but these are people who have very unusual expectations. And that reminds me of this story. You'll recognize it immediately, right? This is Naaman from, oh my gosh, I'm going to get it wrong now. He was Assyrian, wasn't he? Assyrian, yeah. And of course, he had leprosy, and he was told to go see was it Elijah?
Elisha,
thank you. And obviously, I should have read this passage a little bit more in detail. And but we all know it. And so he went, and Elisha says, hey, go bathe in the Jordan. Well, everyone else knows it. Elisha says, go bathe in the Jordan seven times. And Naaman says, you know, let me find the appropriate word for Manuka. No, I'm not doing that. And he goes back, and eventually he repents and comes back and washes and is saved, right? And it's very interesting. I mean, I see a lot of Naamans. And, you know, I tell these people, you know, this is what you need to do. And they really question me, you know, are you sure? And, well, yeah, I went to school for a long time to understand these things, and I'm very sure. And they leave, and they're skeptical. And I know they're going back to their ginseng, and more power to them. I mean, if that makes them feel better, that's great. But, humans, funny people, because they have these different perspectives. They had, you know, some bad experience with a doctor when they were 5 years old, or their mom did, or whatever, and now they don't trust doctors. Doctors are evil. Doctors are lying to you. You're all about money. You know, I only prescribe medications because I get a cut, which is completely untrue. If I wish that a drug company would give me a cut of the drugs I prescribe, but they don't. I've offered, but they don't. It's terrible. I'm really hard done by. All right. Where am I? So, I don't know if you get this sense, but sometimes I get a little bit jaded with my life, with my job. And it's not, you know, it's never a black and white thing for me. I just, you know, sometimes I have these patient encounters, people who spit at me, and I just think, you know, this is terrible. Why am I doing this? I don't get paid enough to deal with this. But that's not really what it's about. It's not really about pay. What it's about is doing the right thing, is doing the Christ-like thing. So, for example, we go back to that 22-year-old woman who, you know, has a toothache. We, you know, give her a little bit of Tylenol. She feels better. We send her to a dentist. And, you know, it occurs to me, and I hope I don't sound arrogant when I say this, but it occurs to me that that could be Christ in disguise, because we're all familiar with that verse, and I have it later on. It'll come up in a minute. My slides are a bit out of order. But we know that verse where you're at the judgment seat, and Christ says, you know, when I was in prison, you came to visit me, and when I was hungry, you... Yeah, I'm not quoting this right, am I? And the converse, he says to the people on the left hand that, you know, when I was in prison, you didn't visit me. And it occurs to me, you know, some of these really stressful patients who I don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling at the end of the day, I think, well, I did my best, and I tried to be nice, and I tried to do it with a smile, and I don't really feel vindicated inside, but maybe, you know, this is me actually doing the right thing, and I should feel comfortable with this. So, where am I in my notes? I want to share with you one, probably the most powerful thing I ever learned in my training. And I've done a lot of training. I'm a slow learner, so it took me a long time. But I've actually gone to university for 13 years, and I don't have much to show for it. But over those 13 years, I have had literally thousands of teachers, because some of these rotations, I would have a different teacher every day. And of these thousands of teachers, I've had fantastic teachers, I've had terrible teachers, I've had everything in between. And this one particular encounter I had was with a psychiatrist in Prince George. I was not the patient. And I was working with him for a month. And this was a really interesting guy. I forget what denomination he was, but he was a deacon in his church. He was a religious guy. And we had a lot of very interesting, he's a psychiatrist, so we had lots of very interesting conversations about demons and whatnot. And he said a very interesting thing to me. This is an aside, I'm getting off topic. He said to me, I asked him, you know, you're a psychiatrist, the Bible talks about demons, have you ever seen a demon? And he said, well, you know, I can honestly say that I've never seen a demon myself. I've never had a patient who I thought had a demon. And I thought, well, that's very honest. You know, that's a really neat thing to hear from someone who does this for a living. That was not the most interesting thing or the most powerful thing he told me. One day we were in the emergency department, and I was complaining because we had a patient coming in who had come to emergency. And in Canada, it costs the government $500 for someone to go to emergency. And that's before you do anything. That's just to show up, sign up, whatever. It costs the government $30 if they go to see their family doctor. So going to emergency for a runny nose or a note or a refill of your medication, it's terrible. It's a terrible, terrible waste of money. And just like any country, we don't have oversupply of it. So I was complaining about this, and I was talking about how, you know, we should have user fees or something. And what this man said to me, told me, "Jonathan, we're in the business of mercy and not justice." And that was my epiphany moment. That was my hello, David. It was this kind of this click in my brain, and it was like, oh yeah, I'm here to try and help people. I am not here to try and police them. And when you think about it, that's what we're here to do as Christadelphians. We are in the business of mercy and not justice. Well, that's not entirely true. My aunt works for a police department, so she's in the business of justice, but not when she's wearing her Christadelphian hat, I hope. So this was a very potent thing for me. And then I started thinking about this more and paying attention to it more, because in that time I was part of an ecclesia that was having a lot of upheaval and has since almost completely dissolved, which is very, very sad. And I compare that to going to work, where you have this group of people of all different religious backgrounds, and in the Canadian medical system, there is no religion whatsoever, with the exception that, you know, if you're dying, you can ask pastoral services to find someone from your church to come comfort you, but nothing beyond that. And what I was seeing was that the treatment and the behavior someone was exposed to when they were in the hospital in Canada was more Christ-like than what people were getting in the ecclesia that I was going to. And of course, these aren't strangers going to the ecclesia. These are brothers and sisters going to the ecclesia. So this was a very, very potent experience for me, and something that I don't think I'm ever going to forget. Well, hopefully I'm never going to forget that. We don't know what happens when I get a little bit more senile. I want to read you what has become my favorite passage in the Bible. And if you have your Bible handy, you want to read along, that's fine. Otherwise, I will try and read it to you in a somewhat comprehensible manner. John chapter 8, you're going to recognize this immediately. So Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him and sat down and taught them. And he taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. And placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law of Moses, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say?" And they said this to test him, of course, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus, as we know, bent down and started writing with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and he said to him, said to them, the Pharisees, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and from now on sin no more." This, in my line of work, I can't really explain why, but this has become probably my favorite passage, because I see an awful lot of pain. And I'm not talking about physical pain, I'm talking about emotional pain that people inflict on each other because they don't understand, or they don't choose to follow the second law that Jesus gives us, you know, to love your neighbor as yourself. And I think it's tragic. Jesus, of course, is well within his rights to pick up a stone and throw the first stone because he's perfect. And yet, he doesn't. And that's very interesting. I don't drink alcohol. It's not entirely true. Once a week, you know, at communion, I'll have a little sip. But otherwise, I don't drink alcohol. And it's just a decision that somehow I made earlier in my life and have never gotten around to changing. And I don't miss it. You can take me and you can put me at an open bar and there is zero temptation. I have zero temptation to drink alcohol. I'll take a ginger ale, you know, that's it. I don't smoke, so same thing. There's no temptation for me for smoking. I don't gamble. I'm a pretty clean living guy. And I'm not telling you this to boast. I'm telling you this because I see people come into emergency who have all these problems. They are alcoholics who have gone to rehab. They've been admitted to the hospital for 48 hours, 72 hours to get them through the DTs. And then they go to rehab, and then they relapse, and they spend their welfare check instead of on rent on booze. And they come back about 4 days later, and I'm seeing them again. And I see smokers, and smoking is a very, very difficult habit to kick, who are struggling, and they're trying to get rid of the cigarettes. I had a guy once come to me in emergency in a suburb of Vancouver, and he had an addiction to gambling. And he told me the story. He had gone to the casino, and he had lost $50,000, and he couldn't make his mortgage payments. And so his in-laws, loving people, came and they rallied around his family and said, okay, we are going to mortgage our house so that, you know, we can offset this $50,000 so the loan shark doesn't break your legs. And he went to help and he went to rehab and was getting treatment and he relapsed. And so he went back to the casino and he lost another $50,000. So this is no longer his family's money. It's the in-laws' family money and they have a mortgage to show for it. And he didn't know what to do. So he came to emergency. Unfortunately, there's no pill to cure a $100,000 debt or a gambling addiction. It's very easy in my position to sort of sit there and think, you're an idiot, or worse. But I think that's hypocritical. I really do. You know, I can look at an alcoholic and I can say, you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't smoke, you shouldn't whatever. But I'm not perfect. I make mistakes pretty much every day of my life. I'm sure I sin every day of my life. In fact, I think I'm ignorant enough that I'm not even aware of all the times I'm sinning every day. So for me to sit there and criticize someone who has a problem that has nothing to do with me because I happen to be good in that one particular area, I think that's hypocritical. I don't know what you guys think, but I think it is. Wow, that's about an hour. I should probably move this along a little bit. Is anyone sleeping? Okay, I'm going to skip through that, and I'm going to roll around to my conclusion. So, last couple of minutes here, what I want to do is talk about, or just recap what we've talked about, and that is the way we look at the world as individuals, because we all have rose-colored spectacles. And if you think you don't have rose-colored spectacles that affects the way you look at the world and you don't think you're biased, that is your rose-colored spectacles. All right? So if we can be aware of that, we can't eliminate that, you can try, but if you can be aware of that and try and take measures to minimize that, I think we're all a lot better off. If you know what sort of circumstances make you hot around the collar and, you know, make you do things that you regret later, then you can work hard to try and avoid that or prevent that or enter into that a different way or develop a strategy to deal with that. And I'm telling you this because over my 13 years and I don't know, it's been a long time since I started medical school. But however long that is, I have, you know, every once in a while come across something, some deep evil thing in my soul, and I think, oh, that's bad. And it's a bad interaction with a patient or a teacher or whatever, and I think, oh, I don't know where that came from, but I'm really embarrassed by it. And I think about it, and I can change it. And I have actually seen some modest success in avoiding some of these things. So it is possible to do these things. It's very difficult. You have to really work at it. But it is possible to change yourself if you're dedicated. But you have to, first of all, be aware of these perceptions. So it doesn't have to be something as serious as that either. It can be something a lot more mild, modest. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. It's past my bedtime. Okay, let's finish this. This is my challenge to anyone who wants to accept it. Over the coming days, weeks, years, whatever, actively seek out new perspectives. Let's take this verse, which applies to us every day of our lives, believe it or not, and let's change it so that though seeing, we may see, and though hearing, we may hear. Because if we start looking for the things we're missing, we're going to start seeing them, and then we can start doing things about them. So that's my first challenge. And already our presenters have provided a few ideas, and I wanted to just quote a couple of them. Our brother Dyron suggested that you can change Bible versions. And I have an electronic Bible, so it is very easy for me to change Bible versions. But I remember when I had a paper Bible, which was not that long ago, I kind of had this emotional attachment to it. And I would sort of stay in the RSV and not really waver from it. But why not? Why not put your favorite Bible on the shelf for a year or for a month and read a different version that you've never read before? Why not read one of these crazy, you know, New Living Word, blossoming, you know, whatever translations, and try and see something new? Because, okay, you might get a few laughs out of it, but you might see some verse that makes you think about something in a different way. What's the harm? I think most of us here have read the Bible enough that we kind of have a feeling of what the first principles are, and we're probably not going to be led astray by reading these, you know. Similarly, have you ever tried reading a different daily planner, daily reading planner? I tried this year completely independently. And I found, again in my iPad, I found something called the chronological reading plan. And I love it. It takes all the books and the chapters, and it goes from the beginning of biblical history right the way through. So you start in Genesis, and then about Genesis 10 you stop and you read Job. And then you continue in Genesis, and right now I think I'm in the Kings, and I'm kind of in the Kings, but I'm kind of in Isaiah, and I'm kind of in Hosea, I think it was. And it's just kind of, it's very interesting, because all of a sudden it brings a whole bunch of books together in a way that I kind of knew fit together before, but never really had that experience. And it's amazing. I am so glad that I'm doing this. I don't think I need to necessarily do it, you know, for the rest of my life, but 1 year of reading, after you've been reading the Bible for a while, why not? It's definitely opened my eyes to a few things that I didn't see before. So it's simple little things like this, that you can actively seek out new perspectives. My last analogy about this, and this is a good analogy, that's why I'm going to belabor this, I think it's a good analogy, is that, like what Adam was saying, when you are doing a job or you're doing whatever for a prolonged period of time, you get into a rut. And the more you go around, the deeper the rut gets. And it gets to the point where you're in this rut and you can't really see over the sides anymore. Adam's flying his helicopter and he's missing the amazing creation around him. I'm working in an emergency department. I'm getting tired because these patients are complaining. And I'm missing the fact that, you know, I can heal broken bones and I can deliver babies. I mean, that's pretty cool, you know? It doesn't feel that cool when I say it, but I knew at one point that seemed really cool, you know? So if you're able to sort of lift yourself out and look at these things actively, I think it helps us renew ourselves and strengthen our faith. Challenge one of two. Challenge two, dealing with other people. This is the danger spot that I think causes more grief or more preventable grief than anything else. And all I'm going to suggest here is that we all deal with people in our daily lives, whether that's your spouse, whether that's your family, whether that's your client or your coworker at work, whatever it is. Try walking the extra mile. We all know this. This is not anything genius that I'm coming up with, but try it. Try to take that alcoholic or whoever that alcoholic is in your life who's coming in, who's relapsing, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, just put a bullet through your head. And don't say that. Instead say, this is someone who, this is an opportunity. You know, I see these charts sometimes and I think, oh, I just do not want to deal with this. And then I think, wait a minute, this could be Christ dressed up. And I'm going to go in there and I'm going to do my best. And you know what? It seems a little contrived, but it works for me. Because it changes my attitude around. It gives me a little bit of a laugh. And I'm like, oh yeah, I need to do this. And I need to do my best. So try that in your lives. Hopefully you're not having to deal with some of the messy things that I have to deal with, but you may be able to find things in your life, people, interactions that irritate you. Try this. And if it works, let me know. Because I'd like to take credit for it. No, I'm just kidding. I think that's about all I have to say. I was going to read six more verses here. Let me just pop this open quickly and make sure I got the right selection here. This was the passage I was alluding to earlier. So this is Jesus. Then the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of those least of my brothers, you did it to me. There, I'm glad I found that, because that was important. That verifies what I was saying. I feel better. I think that's all I have to say tonight. So thank you very much for sticking around for this extra time. I know we've gone quite over due to announcements and other things and my long-windedness, and I appreciate it. I hope it was useful.